This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey, I'm Steve Giatakis.
Okay, good morning, world. I am ready to head out on my 80-mile commute. I have kissed the cats goodbye. I have adjusted the thermostat, and I have my lunch.
Megan Bailey makes the trek almost every day from her home in the Antelope Valley to her office in San Bernardino. It is an hour and a half out and 2 hours back.
It's kind of fun that I start my commute in the dark, so I'm wearing my regular glasses. And by the time I get to work, the sun is coming up, and so I end my commute in sunglasses.
With record-breaking gas prices, Bailey is spending a lot of money on her commute these days. Helping drivers like her is what prompted California's politicians to spend a big chunk of the state budget surplus on rebates for people who own or lease a car. $400 per car. Now, some drivers are thankful for the cash, but others say it's not being distributed fairly. KCRW's Kaylee Wells picks up the story from here.
It's the classic super commuter story. The job is far away, but Megan Bailey's partner owns the home where they live in the Antelope Valley. She's got her daily commute down to a science.
If I take the 15 or the 215 to the 15 to the 138 to get home.
These days, with gas prices soaring up around $6 per gallon, she's spending about $35 a day on her commute, about $10 more per day than when she started making this trek in July of last year. She is all in favor of California handing out debit cards to people who own or lease cars. You get $400 per car, up to two cars.
I'm so glad that that's happening for the people that it will really benefit.
Doesn't matter how far Bailey drives or how much money she makes or even whether she drives an electric vehicle and charges for free. It's a flat $400. And Bailey says it doesn't bother her that someone like me, who owns a car but spends nowhere near so much on gas, gets the same amount from the state.
Not at all, because I'm sure that it's making such a positive impact in your lifestyle. I think at the end of the day, it's about us being okay. And a lot of people aren't okay right now. We're fine.
But not everybody views it that way.
I mean, people that have like Teslas or certain income levels, I think, you know, what they really should do is base it on maybe the amount of driving you're doing. I would like to see it that way.
Chris Allen called the $400 a nice gesture. He schleps multiple times every week from his Valencia home to his Ontario office. And since he works in sales, he also has to drive around to his company's customers.
Generally, I drive about, well, I can drive upwards of about 2,000 miles a month. So that's 24,000 miles a year. And if you divide that, let's say by...
We did a little back of the napkin math and determined he's spending about $500 per month on gas these days, probably around $150 more than this time a year ago.
So that's $500 a month just in gas alone. But of course, there's always other things that cars need, like oil and upkeep and repairs and stuff like that.
The rebate will pay for that difference in the gas price for maybe 2 months for Alan.
I mean, yes, I'm thankful to get $400. I mean, any kind of rebate anywhere I'll be glad for, but I guess I'll take it just because it's offered. I think having the gas tax repealed would be great.
He's referring to the extra 51 cents that California charges at the pump to pay for road repairs and other infrastructure projects. California Republicans actually pitched that idea, repealing the gas tax, last month. The vote failed spectacularly. All the Dems said no. Former Assemblymember Mike Gatto, who represented parts of Glendale and Burbank, isn't surprised.
If you repeal the gas tax entirely, of course, you lose the ability to do a lot of the good things that the gas tax funds, and that includes keeping our roads in halfway decent shape.
Because once you take away a tax, it's not especially popular to reinstate it. Plus, there's no guarantee the oil companies won't take advantage of that by jacking up wholesale costs so the savings don't all get passed on to the consumer. But Gatto is not a fan of the $400 rebate either. He called it gimmicky, saying a temporary gas tax repeal that gets re-triggered when prices fall below a threshold might satisfy more people.
That to me is a little bit more of a thoughtful solution than just sending everybody a piece of mail saying, hey, I'm looking out for you and here's your gift card.
The governor's office didn't grant KCRW an interview, but his office has said the average person getting $400 will get more money in the long run than they would have with a gas tax repeal. And Governor Gavin Newsom said in a press conference that changing the amount people get based on their income isn't out of the question yet.
I'm completely open to work with the legislature if they want to create a framework of means testing. In fact, we've already initiated that going back a week or so ago. So I'm very open to that discussion.
Meanwhile, for people like Bailey and Allen who will burn through $400 in just a couple weeks, will higher gas prices lead to a rethinking of the supercommuter lifestyle? USC business professor Lars Perner says, in a word, no. When gas prices go up, Americans tend to cut their costs somewhere else.
It's very difficult in the short run to change your driving habits much. You just generally end up having to pay whatever extra the gasoline costs.
He says that Econ 101 supply and demand model, where demand goes down and the price goes up, is standard for luxury goods. But we can't cut gas out of our lives as easily.
You can cut out leisure trips, but you usually can't cut out driving to work. We don't really have good public transportation systems in much of California.
Bailey isn't going to stop driving to work, but she said she and her partner might not do as many hiking trips this year, and they decided to cancel their cable.
We already drive a lot, and we get home, we cook, and it's straight to bed during the week. What's the point of having a cable bill?
It could be months before Allen and Bailey get their rebates. If current trends continue, gas prices could be lower by then. In the meantime, Bailey says she's learned to make the most of her long, expensive drive. She stopped listening to the news on her commute and has used the time as a sort of morning meditation.
I think it's kind of neat, actually, to drive through the desert and watch the sunrise and the sunset every day. It's kind of something that I believe is like a treat, you know. Nobody wants to drive 80 miles one way, of course, you know, for their commute. But at least I get to see some natural beauty on the way every day.
And know? Soon the sun will rise on a day when Bailey's commute isn't this expensive. The Biden administration just started releasing 1 million more barrels from the county's oil reserve every day in another attempt to curb the steep prices. And they've already begun to fall. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. A $400 rebate will alleviate some of the pain of high gas prices. And you know what else would? Taking advantage of LA County's mass transit options. But if you hop aboard a subway or light rail car these days, you may come face to face with another crisis, LA's homelessness crisis. Some transit officials are afraid that the system's unhoused riders are preventing a rebound in ridership to its pre-pandemic levels. Overall, bus and train ridership in the month of March was at about 65% of pre-pandemic levels. LA Times transportation and mobility reporter Rachel Uranga is covering the story, and she's with us right now. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Do we know, Rachel, how many unhoused people are riding the subways and light rails? How many encampments are at or near stations?
Well, what I'm told is that LASA actually took a count as part of their count. Previously, they hadn't counted on the Metro, but they did it the last time around. But the agency's taken a count themselves. The last time they did a sort of point-in-time count, they found 5,700 riders who appeared to be homeless, and that was last August.
Is this more of an issue on trains than it is on buses?
Well, you know, Metro took this point-in-time count in August, and they found that there were 4,100 individuals that appeared to be homeless on their buses at that point, and about 1,500 on their rail. But you've heard of sort of the, you've seen, I should say, you've actually seen a lot more homeless on the rails, in part because it's a lot more attractive ride. So for instance, if you're going to sleep on the red line, it might be more appealing instead of taking a bus with all these sudden stops every, you know, couple of blocks, as opposed to going into like this temperature controlled subway that's going to sort of hum along for 40 minutes and do, you know, stops without jolts or anything like that. But there's also been a lot of attention paid to the rails, and Metro has put a lot of resources in there to help get homeless individuals out into housing.
Well, I do want to talk about that, because the MTA says it's not just trying to remove unhoused people. They're trying to find them housing, which is a wonderful thing in concept, Rachel. But I want to say this again. The county's transportation authority is trying to find people housing, which sounds a little odd. What's going on there?
Right. Well, it is. And I think the metro system is definitely not created or have the capacity to be a homeless service agency, but it's found itself as a sort of de facto homeless service agency, like a lot of agencies have. When the pandemic hit, what wound up happening is that the ridership dropped, and there was also a loss of shelter beds. And so a lot of homeless individuals found refuge on the transit system, not only in Los Angeles, but you see it in New York, you see it in other major cities. Most cities have, or a lot of cities, I should say, have responded by basically removing homeless individuals from the transit system. Metro decided that they were going to, instead of removing them forcibly or ticketing them or any other means like that, they were going to help them find shelter. They started off, I think it was in 2017, 2018, they started off with a program. There was a $1 million program, essentially a bunch of social workers going out, talking to individuals and asking them if they need a place to live and if they could help connect them. They found a lot of people, and a lot of people didn't accept shelter. And I think you see that all over the city. So while they're making a lot of inroads and they're contacting a lot of individuals on the system, they're not necessarily getting them the shelter that they hope to be. And they've even gone so far as to pay for an 80-bed shelter in South Los Angeles.
One of the people who didn't want shelter is a woman that you spoke to for the Times piece that you wrote, an unhoused woman on the subway who said she's trying to isolate herself from other unhoused people out on the streets because she's worried that if she's around them, she might relapse. She might use drugs again. Tell us about her.
Sure. I met Tracy Hellams at around 3 a.m. She was outside of 7th Metro Station talking to a social worker, one of the social workers that Metro has paid for. He was trying to convince her to take a shelter bed, and she engaged him, but I think she wound up declining. She didn't want to go into shelter where there might be other addicts or people that might expose her to things that might trigger her addictions or any of her other traumas.
Like there's a lot of temptation out on the streets.
There is a lot of temptation out in the street. And what social workers tell me is that Metro is unique from a lot of the encampments in the streets of Los Angeles in that the people that tend to be attracted to the Metro are individuals who are either new to the streets and they're not sure really where to go, or individuals who tend to have higher rates of mental health problems. So Metro tends to be for people who want to isolate and not be near other individuals who may be going through what they're going through.
So it's kind of like a catch-22, right? Like the reason a lot more folks are on these trains is because there are fewer riders on the trains, right? They're trying to isolate themselves from other unhoused people. And Metro saying, you know, if we get more people on the trains, maybe this wouldn't be the problem that it is.
I think ultimately what Metro wants to do, though nobody has fully articulated this, is Metro wants to lower the number of individuals who are homeless on their system because they want more riders. And people who are taking the system don't necessarily feel comfortable with the level of individuals who are unhoused.
There's also the issue of violent crime on the transit system. Violent crime on the system increased about 36% last year. That's according to Metro, including some high-profile attacks on riders. Is it just a general rise in crime? I mean, how would you articulate that?
The statistics don't really delineate who is committing the crime. We do know that there have been a couple of pretty high-profile violent crimes committed by homeless individuals, one where a homeless individual who apparently had mental health issues attacked a woman who was sitting at a bus stop near Union Station. She fell and later died. She was a nurse at USC, an essential health workers. And I think that incident really shook the board. Not only had violent crime risen the previous year, but writers were saying that they were nervous and their safety was an issue on Metro.
Are Metro's own employees worried about these issues, about the increase in crime?
Well, what we do know is from surveys of employees, they want something done about homelessness. And they're the unions that represent some of the drivers nationally have complained about attacks on operators.
And by the way, these are all issues that other cities are grappling with as well. This is not just in LA, right? Ridership is down in a lot of cities. There are unhoused people who are on a lot of these trains, whether they be light rail or subway, in many other cities too, right? It's not just unique to LA.
No, it's not. It's happening all over the country. And you see it playing out really in New York. I mean, the mayor, Eric Adams, is looking to get homeless individuals off the trains if they're not there to ride it. I mean, if they're not there, if they don't have a destination, I should say.
You know, it's interesting to me that you have all these things coming online. You've got the purple line under Wilshire Boulevard that's opening up soon at La Cienega. You've got the green line. This is, you know, the Crenshaw line that will eventually go to the airport. Like all these things happening, it's got to be discouraging, right? For folks who are mass transit advocates and ridership is so low and they're having these issues.
Quite honestly, my suspicion is that that's in part why they're really trying to figure out how to deal with this situation. The Crenshaw line's about to open. The regional connector is near completion as well. And they have a lot of other projects coming down the pipeline. They want to get people excited and riding the trains and the buses before the 2028 Olympics.
LA Times transportation and mobility reporter Rachel Uranga. Rachel, thank you for coming on and talking about it.
Thank you, Steve.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. If our city won't keep us safe, we will keep us safe. Those are the words a group known as Crosswalk Collective LA posted to Twitter nearly 2 weeks ago. The tweet was paired with pictures that show freshly painted crosswalks at Remain Street and Serrano Avenue in East Hollywood. The tweet got a lot of attention and even requests from people asking the collective to paint crosswalks at other intersections in the city. Here to talk more about this group and how the city has responded is Vanessa Romo. She's a reporter at NPR based right here in LA, and she did a story on it as well. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Steve.
I want to talk about this group, Crosswalk Collective. What do you know about this group?
Well, they're a very secretive group. They have not revealed their identity. We don't know how many members are in the group or who founded the group. What we do know, and I know this by communicating with the group over Twitter, is that they're a small group of people and they say they're fed up, and so they're taking matters into their own hands.
Well, what are they fed up with? Because is it about crosswalks specifically? Is it about city services?
It does appear as though they're upset about a broad range of city services that impact low-income neighborhoods and people of color specifically, but they're focusing their attention specifically on installing crosswalks across the city.
The collective wouldn't talk to you, wouldn't talk to us either. We reached out to them as well, but they did release a statement, and I want to read what it said in part. Quote, "We are a small group of community members who have tried for years to request crosswalks and other safe streets infrastructure the official way. At every turn, we've been met with delays, excuses, and inaction from our city government, as well as active hostility to safe streets projects from city council members." End quote. Active hostility. That sounds pretty damning right there.
Yeah. You know, I asked them about this and I said, can you provide us any, you know, quote unquote receipts, right? In what ways have people responded with hostility? And is there any sort of documentation that you can provide? They say that they do have it, but that in order to protect the identities of their members, they weren't willing to share it with us. So I took it upon myself to reach out to the formal organizations. I reached out to Los Angeles Department of Transportation, as well as the council member in that area of Romaine and Serrano Avenues, where they painted the crosswalks. And I said, hey, have you been contacted by this group? There are no records that point directly to any communication from the group as a collective. It is possible that individual members of the group may have contacted either Department of Transportation, LADOT, or Mitch O'Farrell's office, who's the council member in that neighborhood. But there's no way to know because, you know, the members of the group didn't provide any documentation, and neither of those other two offices can provide any documentation either. And by the way, it had been several years since there had been any requests made either to O'Farrell's office or to LADOT for any improvements on that specific corner. So the last time that any requests were made was in 2017, and it was for a broken street sign. And I think also at the time they installed the stop sign. So they made it, they converted that corner from a two-way stop sign to a four-way stop sign. But again, that was back in 2017, and no new requests for that intersection have been made since then.
There are a lot of things that go into painting things on asphalt, on concrete, right? I mean, it has to last. There has to be some sort of lasting element to it where, you know, after so many cars, thousands of cars go over it, it's got to be able to stay. But also, I mean, the city probably has just a way of doing it, right? And that's how the government works.
Yes, and that is actually one of the things that Mitch O'Farrell's office raised. You know, there is a list, there is an order, there are a number of projects that the city and council members are taking on, and there is a specific order in which they're happening. So, for instance, going back to this specific intersection at Romaine and Serrano, O'Farrell's office said that actually they have a number of additional safety improvements in the works for that corner. However, when I asked for a timeline, I said, hey, okay, great. When is this going to happen? They said, we can't give you an answer. And I think that's the frustration of this group specifically and the broader community in general. You know, the response on Twitter to this single intersection that this crosswalk collective LA painted has been so positive. And there are so many people requesting their own crosswalks and requesting intersections that could use a crosswalk.
The city, Vanessa, has recognized the danger posed to pedestrians in this city because of the car culture, frankly, right? So you have Mayor Garcetti's Vision Zero plan, which is a, you know, has a goal to reduce pedestrian deaths to zero. How dangerous is it? What kind of numbers do we have on that?
The numbers are pretty alarming. According to data from the Los Angeles Police Department from 2021, 128 pedestrians were killed in Los Angeles, which is a 6% increase over 2020. So if you break that down, that means that every 3 days, a person was killed walking the streets of LA, which is 4 times the national average. And then another 486 people, so nearly 500 people, were severely injured walking the streets of LA, which is another increase of 35% over the previous year. And, you know, in a poll of people in LA, the majority of Angelenos said they don't feel safe crossing the street in their own neighborhood.
NPR reporter Vanessa Romo, based here in LA. Vanessa, thanks. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
That's going to do it for us this evening. Tomorrow, COVID is far from over, although the numbers have been down and a lot of restrictions gone for the most part. But there is another Omicron variant, BA2, causing problems in other parts of the world. How LA is preparing in case of a new uptick here tomorrow. On Greater LA. Online anytime, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. Let us know how you're doing. What story would you like to hear? You can grab the podcast while you're there as well. KCRW.com/GLA. Jenna Cagle, Andrea Bautista, Juliana Mayo, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, John Meek, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all made things happen this evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your time and attention. Have yourself a great night.